Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this program. We've got a great program coming up for you. In fact, it's part two of an episode we recorded a couple weeks ago with Dennis Clancy from Team Rubicon. A lot of you may know about Team Rubicon. It's an organization founded by U.S. Army and Navy and other veterans to help the veterans feel like they could give back in their communities and stay part of an active team responding to situations. And it's been a great help for that, but also a way for other people to volunteer and participate in the different things going on in their communities when their disaster happens. So we're going to go ahead and get on into part two of this episode. We have Sam Bradley, my co-host, Dr. Joe Holly from Paragon Medical Education Group, and Dennis Clancy from Team Rubicon. And we pick up in this episode with some more questions about how the team responds, how they get their training, and how they get deployed. So check out this episode with the Disaster Podcast team on Team Rubicon.
So tell us a little bit about some of your deployments and your experiences.
Sure, yeah. I did two deployments with Team Rubicon as a volunteer. Now that I oversee the National Operations Center, or at least our response team there, I am usually here and I'll get out to operations as I'm able to. But yeah, Nepal's a great example. We had about 60 people that deployed there. There was a need in the initial aftermath of providing medical support to some villages that hadn't gotten some attention, because some of them were so remote that you needed to hike into them. And you could be kind of out in the field for several days, and you need some people with good physical fitness to get up the mountains. We try to do everything as cost-effective as possible. There was limited helicopter support for a lot of this, and so we were hiking in. I'm not a medical person myself, but I was hiking in with medical teams and providing the logistical support on those missions. As soon as it started to transition more to long-term recovery, we ended up heading out and just focusing on what other disasters were going on at the time. Also, down in Texas, we had the Wimberley floods that happened in June, so I volunteered for that. I was trained as a chainsaw operator, and so I started doing chainsaw work for Team Rubicon. We also have an amazing program with the Bureau of Land Management to do training to get certification to be a wildland firefighter. So we have that's for Type 2 and Type 1. We've also done some helitack training with them, but that's training that they put on that will facilitate our members to go and do. So that we feel that, one, that gives our members like a skill that they can go out and they can perform that's in line with what Team Rubicon does. And if we feel it just makes them better leaders or more experienced on the responses that we do, right?
So, yeah. Dennis, this is Joe. Could you tell us a little bit about how do you get your people to the scene of the disaster? Do people sort of meet at that location, or are they dispatched from a distant location, or folks are just responsible for getting themselves there? Tell us a little bit about how that works.
Yeah, definitely. So we definitely tell our people never to self-deploy. We want to make sure that everyone that gets to a location is exactly who we need, and that we don't overwhelm, the incident command staff on the ground with more people or the wrong types of people for whatever their response is. So I'll work with the incident commander and determine, how many people do they need, what sort of people they need, and then our national or regional teams will vet those people and send them dispatch instructions to get there. We pay the person's way there, so we'll cover, if they're driving, we cover mileage at a certain rate, we'll cover them to get a meal, or if there's something where it has to be an overnight, we'll get them a hotel. But we cover the expenses for our volunteers to get to the response and to get back.
Yeah, this brings up two questions for me, Dennis. One is, how you were talking about physical agility, and clearly that's an issue for us too, especially when you're climbing around mountains in Nepal and that kind of thing. Do you have a specific standard? How do you confirm that standard? That's the first question.
Yeah, and one of the challenges with such a big organization is you also want to maintain transparency. So back to your question of like challenges, is we always want to make sure that someone who signs up for the organization feels like they have an equal chance given their qualifications to be chosen to go on an operation. Because the last thing you ever want is someone having a perception that you just choose, the organization chooses people it knows. And I think, you know, Team Rubicon's done a good job of trying to set up these classes and curriculums. That's what we're doing with international selection right now. So our international selection program, you know, the person gets vetted with their resume, they get interviewed for their specialty, but then they also go out. Right now, the international selection course, we have one going on this weekend in the Baltimore area, but people can go out there, and there is an element of physical and mental that we put them through a bit of stress, and we try to assess whether they have a certain baseline that makes them ready for an international operation. And if they don't, you know, we'll give, you know, that feedback of what they need to do to go back to prepare themselves, and they can come back to a later, a later date to another selection course.
There you go, Jamie. If you're not doing anything this weekend, you can go out there and have some.
But there we go.
Yeah, because I don't have enough on my plate.
Yeah, really. But that kind of segues into my next question. I mean, obviously, you have, when you bring on somebody new, you look at them, you do backgrounds, you do an evaluation, you give them, this is how things work. But how do you handle, do you have, like we were talking earlier about, you know, people need to be trained constantly to be fresh on stuff, new things come up. So do you have any training associated with your national conference? Do you do it all locally? Do you do it online as well as, you know, on site? How do you handle it?
Yeah, I think it's a case by case basis. You know, all of our operations end up being a little different. I can give you the example of Canada right now. So, we'll be leading this sifting operation. We've started already. And so some of the volunteers that are coming maybe have certain specialties we're looking for, but a lot of them, we just need them to be able to sift through, you know, personal belongings. So we don't necessarily have a curriculum for that for our members. We might in the future. We're aggressively building out the number of curriculums we have. But what we're doing for the Canada operation is when someone shows up to the operation, they'll actually spend the first half of the day going through, they'll go through a procedure for fitting their mask. They'll go through training from a person at the operation on donning their suit and all their protective gear. And then they'll also go through, you know, a trial training of actually doing the SIFT work. So sometimes it's on the operation. Some of it you can do ahead of time. A great example is chainsaw training. You got to be on an op to get that training, but we do have like an online manual, module that takes you through, you know, the structure of our approach and what PPEs needed, all this stuff as like a precursor to getting out on the op. So you have a baseline that you can get certified on before you show up to do the on the job completion of that certification.
Yeah, well, JT, that's definitely the way to do it, because of the fact that, you know, that sounds like a very unique type of deployment. I think, Joe, you got a question?
Yeah, Dennis, could you tell us a little bit about sort of the medical side of the team, what their responsibilities are, how you guys handle, victims or patients that you interact with in the field? And sort of what the responsibilities are of the medical components of your teams.
Yeah, definitely. And this is in the process of evolving, right? When we first went to Haiti, obviously, it was a bunch of guys who were like, hey, we used to be medics. We did have a doctor with us. We had a couple paramedics, and they were largely just, you know, they saw a need and they were fulfilling it to the degree to which they felt they could provide the care with the tools they had available. But, you know, increasingly we see, even in the developing world, that, you know, the the kind of, hey, I can practice medicine is not necessarily, it's not necessarily, we can't necessarily send, you know, medical teams in 2016 and just say, hey, go do what you do. We need a degree of recognition, I think, on the international level to do certain types of medical missions. And so we're actually working with the World Health Organization right now to get recognized on some level in terms of our field medical ability. I'll say the other thing to that is we have brought on a medical director, Dave Calloway, who's works for Carolina Healthcare System. He has a network of doctors and a network of support that's really helping us build out, you know, what is, you know, how do we improve our field medical program? And our international ops chief is very focused on that right now. And I can just say that it's, you know, it's rapidly evolving. But I think, you know, the critical thing for us is that we have, you know, recognition for our status so that we're, you know, increasingly coordinated when we go into the international scene.
So can I do a follow-up question?
Absolutely.
Yes.
And that's really kind of related to what Dennis was just saying in working with World Health Organization and that sort of stuff. So how would you guys get requests for service? I mean, would you be contacted by the U.S. Department of State, or is there some other way that those requests flow to you guys? And then sort of what do you have to do with the governmental side of getting out the door and going where you need to go?
Yeah, a great example is Ecuador, right? So Ecuador recently had an earthquake. The country itself wanted to handle everything in response to the event. And because of that, you know, we ended up working with ministries within the Ecuadorian government to facilitate a response. In a lot of cases, if it's a huge international response, right, it'll be the UN that's involved. There could be some other organization. But in the case of, say, Ecuador, right, as soon as something happens, we're checking all the government websites. We're also calling, you know, people within the government that we already have contacts with to assess whether there is a request for, you know, say, a field medical team one or field medical team two, or, hey, they're allowing people in to do X amount of work. And so we'll proactively reach out in some cases. In some cases, we find, you know, given the country's relationship with the United States, it's best to wait for them to make an international request for assistance, because we don't want to go internationally in a place that we are not welcome. We certainly don't want to go somewhere that would be unsafe for our members, because that's very important to us as well. But yeah, I'd just say it's different for each country. We'll reach out. We'll look at their government websites. If we have contacts there, we'll call them. But we're looking, the easy answer is when they're asking for us to go and it's a safe environment to go. So, you know, as soon as something happens that's big that we think we're going to do an operation to, we'll kick out a recon team or reconnaissance team, typically four members, to get on the ground, to get eyes on, to meet with those people from the government or whatever organization is overseeing the response, and help us to refine that scope and build a plan so that we can send follow-on people.
So looking at logistics, if you have something that you're more or less used to and you kind of know what kind of equipment you're going to need, it would make sense. Now, some of this obviously would be on the responders. I'm sure you have a setup where they need to have a bag with certain things in it, especially those things that support themselves for a period of time. But what about your larger jobs? Say, do you have any caches around the country? I'm thinking, too, about how complicated this can get internationally. But what happens if you get out there somewhere and realize you need those chainsaws and you don't happen to have any? How do you manage those things?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we actually have regional caches in each of our 10 regions. We're also in the process in some cases where a region is so vast that we'll set up an additional place where we have a storage unit. We have a trailer for each region, 14-foot trailer that's got our basic loadout and can be configured with different kits based on what the job is. And so we have systems set in place, given, you know, what the scope of an operation is, what should go on that trailer, and we'll dispatch that. But that happens within the region itself, and in some case, the state, in terms of providing supplies there. For international, you know, usually we'll just bring people through Dallas to bring stuff on to the place. We've looked at over the years different options for freight, but you know, I think we look to have stuff that people can bring on the airplane with them. There's no additional coordination. They take it with them, they use it, and we go from there. So we have, you know, more specialized assets at the National Operations Center now here in Dallas that will just bring someone through if they need to pick something up and bring it on to the operation.
We on the federal government, you know, are expected to have, especially on the DMAT side, I'm sure you are as well, a pack with certain very specific things in it. Do you have anything like that, or is it just more loosely based and left up to the person?
We do have a recommended packing list for all of our members, and there are certain things we do expect them to bring. Usually we keep it fairly broad, and then we just make sure that, you know, wherever they're going through or wherever they're going to, that we have those specialized things, right, that they show up on a work site here in the U.S. That requires hard hats, that we have hard hats for them. Not to give another plug for another national partner, but Home Depot, right, a lot of times when we have operations, we actually set our FOB, or we call it a FOB, our forward operating base, our base of operations, in the parking lot of a Home Depot. And we have a relationship with them, so as we need additional tools, we can rely on them. But we also have a great partner in Tool Bank, which is another disaster response organization that has these 53-foot trailers that they bring around to disaster areas and just supply tools for responders. And they've been a great partner. And very often they'll be co-located with us on our forward operating base. So that also helps bring capacity beyond what we might be able to put on our trailers that we have right now. We also have our mobile command trailer, which is a 53-foot trailer that was built by Tyson. And Tyson will bring that, you know, within a day's notice to anywhere in the United States we need it, so that we can have our command team working out of one place that's got, you know, a satellite for an internet connection where we might not be able to get it. That's through ITD. ERC, which is another great organization. You know, a lot of these partnerships, I think, really multiply the effect we're able to have. And we, you know, we look to, you know, what is the equipment we actually need to own, and where can we leverage people that have specialties that can provide that.
Wow. Boy, in the parking lot of Home Depot, that works out magnificently. Jamie, you have a question.
Yeah, just after the fact of getting back from a deployment, we've talked about quite a bit about helping manage the aftermath of a response. And I'm curious to see, you know, what kind of resources do you provide for your volunteers when they come back from a deployment? You know, obviously we want to have a sense of accomplishment, of helping other people, and that's supportive of our personal psyche. But we also often in these types of deployments or situations, we see things that we can't unsee. And how do you help your volunteers, your teams, manage some of that after they get back?
No, that's a great point, especially when we consider that, you know, in many cases, these volunteers have put off the rest of their life for, you know, say 2 weeks to focus on one particular thing. And all those things that maybe they left when they went to the disaster are still there, and maybe even bigger now, of things that they have to kind of conquer. You know, part of our regional build out of our management structure of our volunteer managers is that we have a wellness person on each staff in each region, right? We also, you know, we have a fairly good network of people to provide feedback if they think someone, you know, might be struggling with issues, that we can put them in touch with our wellness people. There's a great organization called Give an Hour, which is a mental health company and can kind of address extreme instances of that. One of the things we do on the operation that I think is very therapeutic, and it really goes back to our roots in Haiti because, you know, they got into Haiti. It was in the direct aftermath of what had happened, and there was just so much destruction and so much so many injuries they saw, so many horrific things that they saw. And, you know, they sat down at the end of that first day and cracked open some beers, and they just talked through what had just happened. So, you know, we at a minimum make sure that once a day at the end of the day, we have a get together where people can talk through what had happened for the day, provide feedback. They can, you know, tell the story of what has happened, and they can process through it in constructive and supportive ways. I think that really helps on the operation. Within the organization, I mentioned Given Hour and our wellness managers who will follow up. So they'll follow up with members after an operation, see how they're doing, make sure they're on track for everything. If there's an extreme case of something, we also have adopted assist training. Assist training is for someone, this is for extreme cases, who might have indicators that they're considering suicide. And that's really, it's not to solve it for them, because, you know, Team Rubicon itself, we recognize we're not mental health professionals, but it's training for an intermediary to get that person, you know, in this kind of latent time between when a concern has been raised to like when action might be taken, to get them to the right people that can provide the assistance that the person might need. So we try to cover that full spectrum of where people are at. And a lot of it has to do with how we manage people during the disaster, the degree of control and consistency we give our gray shirts, the degree of security we provide them in the process of the operation, you know, I think pays dividends when they respond and when they go back home.
I'm so glad you asked that question, Jamie, because we've talked a lot about that, Dennis, and recognize its extreme importance to keep your provider safe and functional. One last question. I think we're coming up on the end of this fun. But Joe, there's a tornado that goes through Memphis, okay? So you have an operation going out there. How do you actually deploy people? Do you have we on the federal level, when our team goes on call, it's set up a month ahead of time in terms of who's available, and they pretty much have it set in terms of, you know, the different roles that are going to go out and that kind of thing. And I realize your process is more flexible, but do you kind of put it out to everybody and go, okay, who's available? These are the kind of roles that we need. Or do you kind of handpick people based on their expertise?
Yeah, exactly. So our process tornado is a great example, right? Because you can, I mean, it's over very quickly. There's a clear path. You can quickly identify what the work is, and you can get to work. So as soon as a tornado happens, you know, we're active with the various VOADs. We're probably reaching out to the local municipalities. We're listening for any requests for assistance, which usually happen fairly quickly, but odds are, you know, in case of Memphis, you know, we have TR volunteers there. We have TR leaders that are there that can get on the ground very quickly, can meet with those people, do the handshake. If they don't know what Team Rubicon is or what we provide, you know, they can see a face. They can get a tasking from those people. But in the background, as this kind of reconnaissance is happening, we kick out a notification within a certain mile radius of that area to the members to list their availability. So members will jump on, and we get very quick responses from our members because, you know, typically they're aware something just happened, so they're waiting for that email. They'll get on and say, hey, I can take off from this date to this date. Right. As soon as we figured out what our scope is, we'll say, OK, we need X number of people, you know, showing up on X day. You know, once we figured out billeting and food and we have our request and we have our scope defined, you know, they'll get, you know, a second email to confirm their availability. And then, boom, we'll dispatch them out to the area. And depending on how immediate a disaster is, you know, we are, you know, for say, a flood situation, it might be kind of a slow rolling thing, and this process, you know, develops over a week or so. But, you know, for a, you know, massive tornado that we have a request for, you know, we can get people on the ground within, you know, 24 hours, you know, to get that first op cycle going. But yeah, it's really email notification. They say their availability. We go back and forth to make sure they're good. We give them good dispatch instructions where to link up, and the incident commander takes it from there.
Good to know, huh, Joe? They're there for you if you need them.
Oh, absolutely. It sounds like they're incredibly well organized and able to respond quite quickly from, you know, whether it's a domestic or international situation.
Well, let's just hope they don't have to go to Memphis. So, Jamie, I guess we're about at the end of this thing. So
we are, and you know, I think it's you know, it's important to talk about, you know, all the things that Dennis and their team and Team Rubicon have done to make sure they have the people with the right training and the proper resources and everything else. We've done a lot of talking about that. For local responders, you know, being prepared for that once in a career disaster that might come along, you know, having the right training and preparedness, we talk about this every single week, is important. And that's one of the reasons we're so grateful to have Paragon Medical Education Group here as our sponsor, and Joe and the rest of the team there to help provide resources like that when it's needed on the ground in these different locations. So, you know, Joe, I mean, we've talked a lot about the various types of things that the Team Rubicon people are using to train themselves and be prepared for their deployments. But I think, you know, for those first 72 hours on the ground in a given location, it's really imperative that the local responders are as prepared as they can be. And that's something that you guys do an excellent job with.
Well, thanks, Jamie. You know, we certainly agree with that completely, that, you know, any response takes some time to get moving. And the larger the response, the longer it takes to get moving. So being ready for whatever's coming your way is part of what we try to do so that folks can participate and be effective in their ability to respond. So anyone that's interested in talking to us about that, we have some information on our website at paragonmedicalgroup.com, or you can find us through Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and you can always find us through the Disaster Podcast.
And folks, you know, reach out to them if you want Joe and the team to bring some of their fantastic experiential training into your organization, in your jurisdiction around the country. You definitely want to reach out to them and take an opportunity to do that. And while you're there, make sure you say thanks to them for supporting the Disaster Podcast. Joe, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, as always.
Sam, where can folks find you?
In the usual social media places, Facebook, Twitter, etc. That's under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And hopefully Rubicon will have a whole influx of new volunteers when everybody listens to this podcast. And hopefully we can get him back or some of his folks, because we asked a lot of questions, but I'm sure we can come up with a lot more.
And Dennis, where can folks find, where's the best place for somebody to reach out to Team Rubicon to find out about your organization and to follow what's going on with your various deployments?
Yep, our website has a ton of information. We will always experiment with new social media. So we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Periscope, we're on Snapchat. Our comms department leans forward on making sure that we're, you know, in all of those avenues. So if you're on social media, chances are you can find us.
Excellent. And on your website's teamrubiconusa.org, and I'm sure you're under Team Rubicon in most of those social media settings. So I'll make sure I have links to that in the show notes so that people can find you very easily from the Disaster Podcast page for this episode. So, Dennis, thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you guys so much. I appreciated it. Anytime.
And folks, you know, I'm Jamie Davis. You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most locations out there on social media, and of course here at thedisasterpodcast.com. And if you have a question that we didn't ask Dennis and you want to get a response, you can always leave a comment on the episode. Just scroll down to the bottom of that episode page and you'll find the comments area. Leave a comment there. It emails me right away, and we'll make sure we shoot Dennis a question, and he can either email us back a response, or can go directly on there and leave a response himself. But we'll make sure we get answers to your questions about Team Rubicon and this type of this specialized disaster response. So we'll make sure you do that. Just head over to disasterpodcast.com. You know, Sam, we've talked a lot about different things that Team Rubicon does and other NGOs do here on the course of covering things here on the podcast. And we hear about the same types of response issues, the same types of logistical challenges and how to overcome them, even the medical response.
Yep. I'm really impressed with what Team Rubicon does, and we'll definitely be keeping an eye on everything they're doing now that we're hooked up on social media. But it's just another great example of the fact that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.